morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. In February, Dr. William Kanick and Dr. Randall Adams testified before a state legislative committee about their study, which found that 1 in 5 construction employees in the state in 2006 were misclassified or paid under the table. If you own a construction company and you classify a full-time worker as an independent contractor, you can avoid paying your fair share of unemployment taxes and workers' compensation premiums. Joining us are Dr. Kanick, who is a sociology professor here at MTSU, and Dr. Adams, who is an assistant professor of sociology at Tennessee Tech. Thanks for being with us this morning. Appreciate
it. Thank you. Good to be here.
And we have two gentlemen sharing one mic due to technical issues, so we'll try to make sure everybody talks up nice and loudly and everything. What led the two of you to decide to crunch the numbers and investigate what might be going on in the construction industry? How did this issue come to your attention?
Well, we each have an established professional practice in this field. And the middle of 2009, I was approached by the Mid-South Carpenters Regional Council. That's a geographical administrative division of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters. There have been similar, although not methodologically identical, but fairly similar studies done in more than a half dozen other states, from Florida to Illinois, Michigan, New York, Massachusetts, Maine, etc., which have examined this issue, that is, the economic and social consequences of misclassification and underreporting of workers in the construction industry, and in some cases more broadly for the whole state economy. The federal government has published reports on this issue, so there's a reasonably well documented in the research literature interest in the extent and consequences of this. The carpenters were interested in funding a study by academic researchers who would have established objectivity to do a study in Tennessee. And they approached me because of my background in this field. I'm a known researcher by my academic publications. And we negotiated what that would contract would be, and I invited my collaborator, Dr. Adams, who is a graduate of MTSU, I should note, and also a little school in Knoxville that's not part of our system, but is a public UT Knoxville. Yeah. And but he, I'm familiar with his, from our prior collaborations, with his interest in and his skills as a researcher and a writer, and it seemed like it would be appropriate in this project for us to collaborate. He, to my great benefit, accepted the invitation, and so we developed a methodology that would address the issue, and so that's how we got into it.
Dr. Adams, what sorts of sources did you and Dr. Kanick go to for the data that you used in the study?
Well, we used the American Community Survey, which records a lot of data about various aspects of the state and characteristics of how people work, how they industries and things of that nature. So we used that. We also contacted the Tennessee Department of Labor to get statistics from them that they had gathered. And then we used some IRS data that they had collected. And so primarily what we were trying to do is this is not an empirical study itself, but more of a predictive model. So what we used is data that had been gathered in an empirical manner. And then we looked at this data, kind of distilled it to make sure that we were looking at comparable figures for everything. And then we took this data, compared particularly data that had been gathered by the federal government and the IRS versus what had been gathered by the Tennessee Department of labor. And then we were able to see if there's any discrepancies that might be there.
And did you find discrepancies?
Yes, we find that there are discrepancies in the numbers.
How much money are we talking about these practices costing Tennesseans in tax dollars? Potentially, you know, millions, but in 2006, I believe it was something like 90-something million dollars in workers' comp premiums alone?
Well, our report estimated a range of people who might be classified as misclassified or unreported. And so I'd be cautious to simply select the outer range of estimates as the only figure that is important here. While the upper range, when we took the Tennessee Department of Labor data on wage and salary reporting, the IRS reporting the people who file tax returns as self-employed, and then the American Community Survey estimates based on their intensive survey of the state of the number of people actually employed in construction, we found really something between, I'd say, 11 and 20%. So there's certainly a range. The reason I say that is I'd be cautious about just taking the 90-plus million dollar figure for workers' comp premiums. Mm-hmm. It could be half that amount. Still a substantial sum. And your question asked about the missing taxes. In Tennessee, of course, we don't have an income tax on wages. So while in other states there were estimates done in these studies, comparable studies of lost taxes, ours did estimate lost federal taxes, but did not address the issue of lost wage taxes because we wouldn't apply here.
But in each category, whether it's federal taxes, workers' comp premiums, whether you accept the low end or the high end of the estimate or something in between, we're still talking millions of dollars.
Yes, that's correct. The estimate would be on unemployment insurance. I don't have the figure in front of me, but I think it was 5 to 11 million dollars. Yes, roughly $4.5 to $11.5 million approximately. So we're not talking a trivial amount. And as your question implies, in a difficult economy where revenues there are tax revenues obviously in the state, but dropping revenues and the difficulties in funding state programs like unemployment insurance, where because of the high levels of unemployment in our state, we've been facing a critical shortage of funds in that pool of monies that's supposed to be generated from employment. We're required, mandated by the federal government to keep it solvent. We face some tough choices as a result of the degree to which this underpayment into these required funds has resulted from misclassification and underreporting.
In addition to the money that the state government is being cheated out of, what about the human costs that you talk in the report about denial of workers' rights, low wages, even fatalities as some of the results? The report states, working in the underground construction economy is like working in the 19th century when it comes to labor rights, protections, and employment standards. So talk about the impact that this has on the workplace, the construction workplace, and what toll this takes on the people who actually labor there.
Well, our study itself was not directly a study of employment relations in the workplace. We were contracted to do a study of the estimate of the number of people involved and its economic impact on state programs. There have been other state studies which have more directly addressed this, and so to the extent that those studies have directly addressed employment relations in construction and characterized them as comparable to 19th century standards. We don't disagree that if our data are correct, that it would provide a foundation for characterizing employment relations that may exist in some construction sites as having those qualities, which are, you know, not something we would applaud or wish for our fellow citizens. But it's important to recognize that while there are important conclusions to our study, that we did not to also understand the limitations on what we can directly address. So framing our study in the context of these other studies, we can legitimately characterize that, to the extent that this is the case, what is happening in Tennessee is almost certainly in common with what has been observed in other states when those conditions, in terms of avoiding proper classification, avoiding any reporting of workers, exists. Also working with the Tennessee Occupational Safety and Health Administration, TOSHA, we did interviews about the degree of increased risk that occurs on work sites when people are not subject to the proper classification, and the and contractors who are likely to underreport, not report, or misclassify workers are characterized by them as more likely to operate a work site that doesn't implement the full range of required safety provisions to guard workers. So,
Dr. Adams, did the survey, the study, look at all into why there has not been stricter oversight or policing in this area?
We looked at some of the recommendations of other states. We did not look at that per se. Once again, as I said earlier, it's important to understand the framework of this study, is that it's a predictive model to understand that the degree that this problem might exist in the state. It's not an empirical study. What it's done is we took several states, various states, mostly these states have invested in empirical studies, and so we were able to see their conclusions, what their say percentage ranges were for misclassified and things of that nature. We looked at a couple of cities who have actually, rather large cities, that have actually done these studies. And so essentially what we did in this study is create a predictive model where we can take secondary data from the federal government, the state government, compile this and look at the problem that might exist in your state. And then what this does is it lays a groundwork where you can see that this is why we used estimates and ranges. Is, as I said, we're using secondary data, so it's been gathered by other people, and it's not necessarily something that we can say this is an absolute. However, we believe that this is a very accurate predictive model, because most of our percentage ranges and most of our figures fall well within the ranges of the other states that have actually done empirical studies. So that's the focus of this study, is to determine if this problem potentially exists within the state. And that's basically what our study suggests.
And I might say Dr. Adams' characterization of empirical simply means that we did not directly go to work sites and gather data by direct observation. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to translate that.
Right. Based on what you discovered, or the empirical, study work that you did, what sorts of conclusions did you come to about what can be done to make sure that workers are classified properly, and that the proper amount of workers' compensation premiums are paid?
That's that is the difficult question that we face. That is, knowing this, what do we do? As academic researchers who operate in an applied environment, of course, our first conclusion is that we need more study. and we would be happy to do as scholars have done in other states and respond to a mandate from the state of Tennessee to conduct a more direct study of the extent and intensity and consequences of this issue.
Especially if you get a nice grant to help fund the study.
Well, research is not free.
That's right.
That's true. Mm-hmm. So my first conclusion would be, as academics always finish their empirical studies saying, we recommend more research on this topic. But in terms of our recommendations, which is the real thrust of your question, we do have some excellent models from initiatives taken in other states. And in some cities, Dr. Adams referenced studies done in Austin, Texas, for example, and in New York City, in New York State. But the actions taken from California to Florida to the Midwest and the Northeast suggests that there is real efficacy in having a set of new laws that have more stringent reporting requirements, better regulatory enforcement. In the state of Florida, in about a six-year period, through a multi-agency task force, more strict enforcement of reporting on-site audits, etc., they were able to significantly drop what they perceived as the extent in their state of misclassification and underreporting of workers in construction. And in fact, they gave testimony to the same House committee that we spoke to and noted that they found our conclusions to be extremely consistent with what they had found in Florida when they did earlier studies, and they felt that our recommendations, which were consistent with the initiatives taken in Florida, would have exactly this kind of result, because they found that to be the case. And in Florida, the extent of misclassification and underreporting in construction was rather higher than it is, at least by the data that we have, than we think exists in Tennessee. Not that it's trivial here, but they had a really intense problem in Florida with the building boom, mm-hmm. in residential construction, with the high level of immigrant workers that they found were much more likely to be employed in these conditions. In Florida, they had a 50% drop in building permits in 1 year when we had our national financial crisis with its impact on construction, and there was fundamentally no drop in recorded employment in the construction industry, with a 50% drop in building permits and construction projects. What that told us was that the elastic workforce was working off the books.
Even commonsensically, that's a red flag without any academic analysis to it.
So what we do know from the state of New York, developed a multi-agency task force in which they worked with district attorneys at the local level, with the Department of Labor, with other state agencies, swoop down on a work site and take control of their record keeping and interview people on the work site, people from unemployment, workers' comp, Department of Labor, other agencies, and district attorneys, to really get an on the ground understanding, and then strict enforcement with much more severe penalties for those. This has a what we would call a demonstration effect for other contractors who would seek to avoid these heavy fines, and also also being cut off from future contracts with state agencies, which for many people might be the most severe penalty.
Do you think that your model, the model for your research, would be applicable on a national scale?
Well, to the extent that we incorporated data from the American Community Survey, which is done nationally by the Bureau of the Census, the IRS data on tax filings, which of course are scrubbed of individual identifiers, of course, but are available at an aggregate level by the industry, and then the state departments of labor have pretty accurate data on reported wage filings for their industry. So this is a national pattern in which we would be able to extrapolate or do a national study, certainly, yes.
And then more federal pressure perhaps could be brought to bear then.
Well, and the IRS is interested in this, as are other federal agencies, to the extent that taxes, the federal government has its own financial or fiscal crisis. We find that their federal agencies are expressing significant interest in this issue, and they're well aware of the results of the studies that have been done at the metropolitan and the state level.
I know you guys are not economists, you're sociologists, but you did bring up a downturn in building permits, and I'm wondering to what extent all of this is mixed up with the burst of the housing bubble and perhaps a sense of desperation on the part of certain people within the industry to cut corners.
I'll take a first shot at that.
It would be only anecdotal. I know that's not something that you studied as academics, but
the answer to that is that we have, in the last decade, a number of studies that have been done that have gathered very consistent and comparable data, both methodologically and in terms of their results, prior to the burst of the bubble. So on the upside and on the downside of the housing bubble, nationally, we saw very similar results. And so I wouldn't say that we might attribute these practices to people trying to maintain their profit margins during a down economy. It's clear that these practices were widespread and consequential for multiple states when the economy was doing well.
Dr. Adams, is this a model that you use that could be applicable to studying other types of industries other than construction?
It is, and that's one thing I would like to point out is we focused on the construction industry because in many of these studies we looked at, that was their focus because it might lend itself more to this practice. However, in many studies what we found out is there are actually other industries that practice this idea of independent contractors and paying people. There were a number of industries that might be involved, and I won't name specific industries. But generally, if you hire people to do work, you can basically classify them as an independent contractor. So what happens then is anybody could actually practice this, and the outcomes would be the same. We focused on construction, as I said, because many of the studies that we looked at had focused in that area. And that was just one of the areas that they had been concerned with. And construction industry data is readily available.
So, for example, in Middle Tennessee, the music industry would be an example where this might be a widespread practice. Mm-hmm. And we also see in anecdotal conversations with executives and managers in a number of other industries, manufacturing, for example, we've seen a widespread practice, although we have not studied the degree to which this is occurring, of hiring managers as independent contractors when in fact they are reporting and working as a regular salaried employee.
With all of the company benefits.
Well, they don't get the benefits. That's the point.
That's how they're
independent contractors,
I
right?
See.
So no pension, no health care, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. In the other studies that you looked at that have been done in other states and other localities, did the extent of unionization make a difference, either positively or negatively, on the degree of misclassification? Or was it even examined?
There was some discussion of that. Some of these studies were done in states that have substantially higher what we call union density levels. The state of New York, for example, has multiple studies. New York City would have a much higher level of union density in construction and in the city than Tennessee. Massachusetts, Michigan, which is a heavily unionized state, all these things are relative. It's not the majority of workers. And in those states, they did find widespread and extensive and intensive use of these practices. So it was interesting to us when we first became involved in this project and began reviewing prior studies that were out there, that in states that have high levels of union density, these practices did exist at a high level.
I ask the question because I was wondering whether or not a construction workers union would be diligent about making sure everything was on the up and up in this regard. So what you say is very interesting in light of that.
I think there's a lot of interest among the building trades unions in as well as among businesses that follow the law in having the law both followed and enforced. But it's not always so easy to get access to work sites and to find regulatory agencies that feel comfortable both investigating and prosecuting violations of the law.
Would you say that if the law is to become stricter, that it is the honest contractors who are hacked off about what's going on who are going to have to use their leverage to get tougher legislation passed?
I think they're already doing that. I think many of them have expressed their interest in having the state provide a level playing field in which they can compete and, in their minds, succeed if the laws are followed by all of the players, by their competitors.
The image of corruption, for some reason or other, has long been associated with the construction industry, and I say image. In the North, it's more of an alleged association with organized crime, and this is not to smear the entire construction industry or its honest, upstanding practitioners, but why does this image of sleaze seem to hover over this particular industry?
Well, first I'd say our study has
nothing to do
with that. As a homeowner who has had to contract with people to do work, I've had my own frustrations, but that's I say that in good humor because I've also had wonderful experiences with very competent and legitimate contractors. So I think as in any business, there are people who practice whether it's medicine or law or construction, there are people who will take advantage of opportunities to misbehave. And the nature of construction work is that it's project work as opposed to process work. Mm-hmm. And one of the natures of project work is that if things have not been properly done, the contractor may often be gone. And then you have a limited term relationship. And so we're all well aware of the difficulties of continuing of enforcing a contract after the work is already done and you have to live with the results. So we're all sensitive to contracting and the possible malfeasance of people in contracting because of that. Perhaps that's why there's this, what you suggest is a reputation for the industry. I'm not sure that it's terribly different than other comparable industries.
If you don't have time to read the entire study, I would refer you to an editorial that ran in the March 5th edition of the Tennessean, still available, I believe, at Tennessean.com. and the newspaper took a position very much influenced by the study by Dr. William Kanick of MTSU and Dr. Randall Adams of Tennessee Tech about the misclassification of workers in the construction industry. Fellas, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting us.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Loeb. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can pick up the podcast at your leisure by going to mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.